Welcome to The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chinen.
How are you, Nate?
I'm doing great.
Fresh from Chicago.
That's right. I just blew in.
Yeah.
I had a really wonderful International Jazz Day experience there.
Sorry that you couldn't take me.
You know, all I can say about it, Josh, is like, that's the kind of production where they say, okay, what are we going to do for our Chicago blues segment? How about Buddy Guy?
Sure, why not?
It's nice to encounter a production where, you know, the resources do not seem to be a problem.
Yeah.
just get the guy, get the real guy.
Get the thing you need.
It was very exciting.
Well, welcome back. I had a really great conversation with the bassist Carlos Enriquez, who has effectively almost come through the entire system of Wynton Marsalis and jazz at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
From the very earliest part of his career and now with the orchestra for a number of years.
You know, I was trying to think back to the first time I saw him with the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. And it probably was like 2003 or something like that, right?
Pretty early. Yeah.
And he was, I mean, was he still a teenager at that point, or maybe he was like 20 or something? And the crazy thing is, he already had history with the band, you know, having come up through essentially Ellington and, you know, so it's really remarkable. I don't even know how many great concerts I've seen with him in that band, you know, but quite a few over the years.
Well, we have an opportunity to talk to him because he just released an album, Monk Conclave. Really, really great stuff. You know, he's done these series of Conclave recordings and he's landed on somebody who I think is very central to the story of the area around Lincoln Center and San Juan Hill. So it was great to kind of hear how he sort of reclaimed some of that story. And we also got a chance to talk about just what's the future at Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
Yeah.
You've got my attention.
Okay, then. Shall we listen? Welcome into The Late Set, the bassist of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. Of course, there's a lot more to that. And a wonderful artist, Carlos Enriquez. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate this.
Man, you have had a pretty nice run of recordings lately. You had the South Bronx story, A New Eurekan Tale, and now you've got Monk Conclave coming out, sort of reimagining the music of Thelonious Monk, which to me sort of harkens back to a project you've done before as it related to Dizzy Gillespie,
Dizzy Conclave.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what provoked you into this space. Maybe something about Monk's music that structurally kind of fits the aesthetic of Latin music.
So, I mean, as a young student, I was heavily in love with Monk's music. It was one of the first things, believe it or not, when I first joined Wynton's septet, I was 16, turning 17. And one of the first things he did, we used to do these in-stores. They don't do that anymore, but we used to do in-stores. And we used to go to these music stores, you know, like Tower Records.
J&R.
The J&R down by Battery in the city. And we would play, you know, it would be, you know, related to an album or whatever. But Wynton then would take out about 30 CDs every time we would do it. And he would stack them up. He says, look, these are the CDs I want you to listen to. Primarily, most of them were all like Monk music. It was Monk, Miles, Dizzy, but it was a lot of Monk in it. And I was like, wow. So he says, just, you know, go home, study them, you know, and just show me what you got. And I started doing it. I started, you know, at that age, I started kind of learning Thelonious Monk's, you know, intros and whatnot on piano. And man, I started falling in love with it. And then the rhythms, you know, I my background, you know, I'm Puerto Rican. I'm a New Yorker, right? So I was born in the South Bronx, New York. And the music that I listen to has a lot of rhythms. And, you know, when I listen to Monk, I listen to rhythms. I listen to the way he formulates his solo and how he, you know, his concept of sound, melody. So all that stuff struck something in me. And as I, you know, as I aged or got better and better at what I was doing, I've always wanted to do something to reimagine or to honor Thelonious Monk or Dizzy Gillespie, you know, and just show the world that these cats, you know, they have groove, man. These cats basically showed us that this music is not just one, it's not one dimensional, it's, you know, it's three dimensional. There's a lot of African rhythms involved in that music that if you know what it is, you can see it. So, you know, I was just basically decoding everything they were doing.
I would imagine that the early part of your life, you were probably hearing Bobby Valentin and, you know, El Rey de Bajo and all these incredible, Andy Gonzalez.
Andy, he was my mentor. Was my mentor. Bobby Valentin was a great, great inspiration. You know, Victor Venegas, Joe Santiago, Ruben Rodriguez, I can name them all. They all helped me. And, you know, Victor Venegas was teaching at my junior high school in the South Bronx. So, I mean, the book was written. I mean, whoever wrote my book, Lord, thank you, because they put me at the in the right location. I mean, I was literally in a junior high school with the basis of Mongo Santa Maria and Carl Jader. And this guy was working with a group called Los Cumbancheros, which was a basic group that just took inner city kids that learned how to play percussion instruments. They sung in choirs. And he was a part of this. And I used to hang with him. And he would tell me stories about Paul Chambers, because Victor was from Chicago. And he would say, man, when, you know, Paul would come by, I would hang with Paul. And this is me. I'm a kid. I'm 12, 13, listening to this guy. And I'm like, Paul Chambers, who's that? You know, and at that early age, I started investigating. I said, oh, it's this guy. Everything has a certain meaning, reference in terms of rhythm. It's unbelievable how you look back now at what I was dealing with in junior high school and how I was just connecting the dots. And yes.
You mentioned what an amazing story. I think you're absolutely right. And so much of it, I mean, first of all, you've been at Jazz at Lincoln Center now for almost a quarter of a century.
Yeah, I've been there. I've been there for a while.
And as you mentioned, in the sort of the orbit of Wynton Marsalis, even before that, there's a way in which you've sort of gone through the system. I know there is no system, maybe, but you know, that from LaGuardia Music and Arts High, going into Juilliard, you won essentially Ellington.
It was exactly the blueprint to how Wynton wanted to see a student grow at Jazz Lincoln Center. And I was just fortunate enough that I was already playing professionally with like Eddie Palmieri, Tito Puente at a young age, that I was able to bypass some of those steps that maybe some other students may not have the fortunate of doing. Not yet, you know?
Yeah.
But I was, at an early age, I was able to jump those hoops. I was able to deal with EE, I think it was the first year, 95 or 96.
That's essentially Ellington.
Essentially Ellington. And you know, my connection with the orchestra at the time, Rodney Whitaker, Reginald Veal, Ben Wolf, was special. Connecting with Wynton, that was very special. He always had this thing about helping young students. I don't know where he got that from, but not just me. I saw many other students go down the same path, and he just laid it out. He helped them out. He took his time. And primarily is the reason why we have many great young musicians that are in my generation that are out there because of him. And, you know, Jazz Lincoln Center, man, there's so much I could say about it. It's so beautiful. You know, they were able to inspire me, give me the opportunity to play. And if it wasn't playing with the orchestra, it was doing, you know, private concerts, educational concerts. They were trying their best to enable some type of a way for the younger musicians to have work and to give them hope, so that they know as they grow and they get better at their craft that there is a light where you can actually work doing, you know, doing this stuff.
Let's talk about this Monk recording. Mm-hmm. You have quite a few of your colleagues from the Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra as a part of this.
Yeah,
and you've got some pretty tremendous guests on this. You've got Osmani Paredes. You've got Pedrito Martinez. Yeah. You've got this wonderful singer, Anthony Almonte.
Yeah, Anthony's in there.
Yeah.
Jeremy Bosch.
Jeremy Bosch, great flute Gonzalo, player and singer.
Gonzalo Rualcaba.
Yes.
Robert Rodriguez. Mikey's on it, too. This was an interesting album because I've always wanted to do it, but it was challenging because, you know, I'm a bass player, you know, bass, Thelonious, pianist. I'm like, man, you know, if I feature myself playing Thelonious Monk's music, it's cool. Don't get me wrong. For bass players out there, it's going to be awesome if you do it. But I wanted to get the right pianist because of not only their understanding of Monk's music, but also their understanding of Afro-Cuban music.
Yeah.
And that's why I got Osmani, that's why I got Gonzalo. And Gonzalo and I, you know, that recording session was the first time I played with him after 26 years since the first time I was with him with his trio when we did the Supernova album. So that was very emotional, and it was a great moment to be around him. And then having Robert Rodriguez, who is Mike Rodriguez's brother, we have I would say, like, the three-dimensional side of jazz and Afro-Cuban. And Pedrito, what can I say? He's the mother. I mean, not the mother, but he's the father of the motherland instrument, you know, of what they do. And it's just an unbelievable experience to feel that. And when you work with these guys and you put these stuff together, man, it's like you feel like the connections, like the blocks just fall in place.
Yeah, there's points in this album where, you know, it sounds like a jazz album, and then it starts to sound like this could be on Tico or Allegri Records or something. Yeah. You know?
It's always been my concept. I'm so happy that you said that, because my concept of the music that I like to reimagine has that orbit, which is I still want the Latin jazz element to always be fresh, the jazz element to be fresh, but I also want to introduce the Alegreosta, the Tico, the Fania vibe. You know, what is New York City salsa? What is the New Yorican sound? You know, what is the Afro-Cuban sound based on a New Yorican ear? You know, like the ears of a New Yorican, you know, Puerto Rican view of what Afro-Cuban music is, you know, and that's what we have done in New York City for many years.
Monk has been almost a fascination with Latin musicians in some sense. There's Danilo Perez with Panamonk.
That's right.
You know, there's Jerry Gonzalez and Fort Apache, that's man. Right. Whew, that's an incredible Monk record.
Yeah.
What is it? Is it the rhythmic code? What is the thing that is the prime attractor?
Well, I think the prime attractor to Monk's music is that Monk, at a very young age, was able to instill in many of the young musicians or musicians that your voice is valuable and unique. And when you listen to Thelonious Monk's music, in the span of Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Charles Mingus, everyone from the bebop era, and you hear Thelonious, you don't hear really the Charlie Parker and the Dizzy Gillespie runs that we would equate bebop with. Thelonious had a very unique sound, that was only he could do it. Yeah. You know, I mean, his closest friend, Bud Powell, he loved Bud, but even the way Bud played was still in the elements of, you know, the bebop, but Thelonious had something very special. So he gave us that tool to grab onto to say, you know what, you know, this voice is very unique and I appreciate that. And we're going to commemorate and honor.
You've put some very important cultural elements from Puerto Rico into this music. I'm thinking specifically of the plena at the end.
Yeah, the bomba plena. Yeah.
First, a quick description of the plena, which is almost like the news of the streets in some ways.
The news of the street, that's exactly what it is. And then bomba, you know, was introduced in the 17th century, I think, in Puerto Rico from Africa. You know, it's funny. It's, you know, we're in Philly, you know, I think of Papo Vasquez, because Papo to this day is a heavy advocate of Bomba en Plena.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I, it's funny, as I get older, you know, I look back to that tradition and I'm like, wow, there's so much in it. There's so much to study and research that I, you know, I commend people like William Cepeda, Papo Vázquez. You know, there's this young bass player named Alex Apollo who plays bass, who also honors that style of music. And I anytime I do a recording, I try my best to at least have one song that pays homage to Bomba en Plena, you know, to a certain degree. I heard Conjunto Libre do it many times, Fort Apache do it. And I think as a New Yorican, it's a part of your job as a musician, and especially as a rhythmic musician, to keep those rhythms alive. Yeah.
And I thought it was a particularly nice part of the Mozambique that you do on this recording as well.
Yeah, Green Chimneys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you get a little spot in there.
I'm not selfish when it comes to bass solos.
Yeah,
I know how bass solos sometimes feel in an audience. You know, it's because I used to joke about it. I have a friend named Roland who jokes about this, and it's hilarious. You know, he makes a joke that, you know, trumpet player, they're playing, you know, and all of a sudden it dies out, and all you hear boom 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 boom. And the bass is soloing, and everybody's like,
"What happened?
What happened?" You know, so people start talking. You know that whole joke about, you know, I'm careful as where to put the bass solos, and you know, I mean, of course, I love to solo. I mean, that's, but you know, my job is very specific, and it's an important role. So, as a supporter of the rhythm and the foundation, it has more value to me in my recordings than just offering a solistic type of way of playing.
Do you feel like it was harder to be the bass player on your own recording than it is to, say, work inside of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, where you're doing all different kinds of things, but this being sort of your music?
I got to tell you, the best part of being a part of Jazz Lincoln Center and Jazz Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton is that we've been given the keys to the Cadillac so many times. There's a group of us that are chosen to do these, you know, to do any type of events that are needed to be done, that we've learned through the years of doing them. So we have so much experience doing it. So, you know, putting this recording together, I had used a lot of those tactics that I learned being a part of the band with Wynton, and, you know, how to put things together, and, you know, me arranging also. You know, I didn't go to school to arrange music. I had to learn, you know, checking out Ted Nash, checking out Wynton's doing his arrangement, you know, Ron Westray, David Berger. And I would just look at the score and be like, oh, so that's what it looks like. I've loved that sound, but now I know what it looks like. So it took years, you know, and then I think 2006, 2007, I started doing arrangements. And then the next one got better to the point where now I'm able to hear what I want to, you know, write what I want to hear.
Did you have any challenges? I mean, where you have a certain conception about how you want one of these Monk tunes to and be like, it's not there yet. What were the challenges?
Well, yeah, that's all. I mean, yeah, the mind will play tricks on you and will take you on an adventure that will never stop. Monk's music can be reimagined many ways, you know, and that's the beauty about his music. There's a lot of space, and it's orchestrated in a way where you can add your own personality to it. But with this recording, I had many options. So, I mean, you know, the one that really gave me the most work was Round Midnight. I really took it upon myself to basically break down the clock, you know, with the 5/4 time signature and the 6 and back to the 4.
You're going to have to explain this to somebody listening. What are you talking about, break down the clock?
Well, I mean, around midnight. And I thought about midnight. I thought about 12 midnight. So then I figured, okay, 12, you know, we could divide it by 2 or 6. I'll keep, you know, some portions in 6, 8, you know. But then I wanted to do something that I learned playing in Danilo Perez's trio when he did Pan a Monk. He has that tune called Think of One.
Sure.
Which is in a clave that Danilo and Jeff Chain Watts created. It's called the 5-4 Latin clave. And, you know, as a young musician playing with Danilo, it was interesting to learn that. And after a while, it became, you know, second nature to me. And I wanted to put this in this arrangement because of that, Pan a Monk. And also because I figured the time signature would have some resemblance to a clock at a certain, you know, at a certain point. You know?
Did you also kind of look to Danilo for inspiration for the Evidence and 4-in-1?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, because we used to play that. That was kind of his solo feature on stage when we would do it.
It worked sort of superimposing those two songs on themselves.
Well, it's again the space.
Yeah.
For some reason, it just works out. I don't know why it works out. And with Thelonious's music, they're both in E flat, the key of E flat for those that want to know. And the way they move, the chord structures fall into the gaps of each other's song. That's the first thing. And then the melody falls into the cracks of the other.
Yeah.
You know, because 4-in-1 has a more moving line, and you know, Evidence has the dun dun dun.
Right.
You know, so you have the breaks, which allows 4-in-1 to slip in. You know, and it just works out. And I thought about that when I wanted to do it. Danilo was a heavy influence on this recording because of Pan a Monk.
Yeah. No, fantastic record.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to talk about San Juan Hill.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to put a little bit of this in perspective for our listeners, San Juan Hill was a neighborhood basically where all of the Lincoln Center campus now is.
Yeah.
And historically, this neighborhood was Caribbean, was Puerto Rican, was Black.
Yeah.
And when Robert Moses came in, and he was basically refashioning the entire city and what they called urban renewal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They basically raised an entire community, close to 20,000 people, thousands of families.
They moved them out,
800 or so businesses, just completely displaced.
Yeah.
So you've got a song on here.
Yeah,
San Juan Hill, and it opens. Yo soy la voz
de los
ancestros de mi gente. I am the voice of the ancestors of my people.
Yeah. It's if people check out my recordings, they know that I have this thing about San Juan Hill. I talk about Robert Moses a lot, and you know, and I'm not the type of person that you know, history and the past is the past, right?
Yeah.
And you know, and I put this on record, you know, if Robert Moses would have never done what he did, I probably would have never met Wynton, gone through Juilliard or LaGuardia. I mean, it would have been a whole nother system, and God knows where I would have been at. So things happen for a reason, but I wanted to pinpoint just the nature of how things ended up being, you know, because San Juan Hill for a while was a rich cultural neighborhood before the Puerto Ricans got there.
Yeah.
You know, it was Caribbean, Afro-Black Americans that had it was beautiful. And towards the latter part of the 40s, you know, the Puerto Ricans after World War II start coming in and start, you know, taking shelter and having a place there because, of course, you know, the Caribbean, it's just like being at home, you know. But, you know, when they started redlining and deeming the locations as slums and having all these Puerto Ricans who who were basically here to try to make a living. You know, it was rough, you know, because the way I saw it, and I might be wrong, but the way I saw it was that a Puerto Rican was disgusting, that it was not, you shouldn't have them around there. And it happened in many other places, not just with Robert Moses. It happened in the Bronx and other locations. And I talk about this. So San Juan Hill, on this recording, Monk Conclave, talks about a person that speaks about the ancestors, about the people that were there before it changed. And it talks about the joy of how the neighborhood was and how much we've tried to change, but till this day we're still in the same orbit of problems, you know, which is probably racism, you know, we could say that. It may not stem directly from Robert Moses, but it's just the whole, you know, what the world is dealing with, you know. And I took that, and it's just, you know, I walk down those blocks every day, and it just, you know, it's crazy, you know.
Do you imagine what was there?
Yeah, you know, the thing that hurts me the most is that Lincoln Center, like, I think they try their best to honor San Juan Hill, but, you know, there's never, you don't hear, like, you know, San Juan Hill Avenue. You don't hear like the Thelonious Monk Reservoir or Thelonious Monk Amphitheater or, you know, the Benny Carter, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I don't think we even mentioned so far that Monk lived in San Juan.
Yeah, Monk lived in San Juan. That's another reason why, you know, he was somebody who I wanted to really honor. And yeah, it's just, you know, and Jazz Lincoln Center is right there, you know? So, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's tough, you know, because we try to aspire as an organization to, you know, bring jazz culture, Latin jazz culture to the highest level. But, you know, when you have history in the past that is tarnished and stained, you know, you can never change it. But, you know, talking about it and you know, letting people know, you know, breaking that egg. Yeah, maybe that wasn't the right way to do it, but, you know, we should still, you know, pay tribute to all these people that got, you know, that left. I mean, I did a lot of research on this, man. I mean, I saw interviews of Robert Moses, you know, pissed, angry that people didn't give him the credit for helping people move to New Jersey, you know? So he did do his diligence of helping at least 2,000 families to move, but there was no way he was going to be able to help everyone.
Soy la voz de los ancestros de mi gente. Quiero que todos sepan lo que sucedió. Afrolatinos en el barrio Zona Roja, luchando juntos pa' que todo marche bien. Somos hijos de la costa.
You say the past is past, but I want to maybe suggest that maybe the past is prologue in some senses. You've mentioned kind of working with Wynton Marsalis now for a very long time.
Yeah, almost 30 years, man.
Coming up into the system, being effectively the outcome that he had hoped to achieve with a lot of the effort that he has put into that organization. So it's not lost on me that maybe there's an interesting narrative that is developing here, as you mentioned in your ongoing story. That, you know, a reclamation of San Juan Hill in some ways. I'm asking you, are you interested in the Jazz at Lincoln Center job? And if so, what would that organization look like with you?
Well, you know, I've thought about it. It's, you know, the blueprint for Jazz Lincoln Center has been laid out. I mean, Wynton busted his behind for almost 40 years.
Yeah.
He worked hard with the board members and all the great jazz musicians before this, a jazz band, members of the Duke Ellington Orchestra with David Berger, you know. I think the question is how, you know, you got to think of Jazz Lincoln Center as JOC 2.0 now moving forward, right?
So how question's still the same.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah. How do you change? You know, it's more, the world has changed after the pandemic with views of how music is brought out to people, you know, based on fear, based on, you know, and you know, the accessibility of now receiving stuff from home. I think JALC, Jazz Lincoln Center, we continue our education program because it's the foundation and the nest of where the future will be. The key is now, how do you provide music, concerts, touring to places that will embrace you? You know, a lot of people think of Jazz Lincoln Center as a bubble, you know, and it's, you know, rightfully so. You have a subscription base of I don't know how many million, and it's just you're in there, you know, so you live in that bubble. The key is, how do we burst the bubble and we bring more people together? And I think the way to do that is to bring different styles of music, you know, the three-dimensional way of thinking. You know, we had Duke Ellington, which was the pioneer to bringing Jazz Lincoln Center together with Winton's ideology. Now is, how do we use that and bring the people of New York City who love, let's say, Afro-Latin music, or people who love Haitian music, people who love Afro-Caribbean music? How do we bring that concept to an organization that loves jazz and that steers it to the highest level? How do we do that? That's a way of thinking. We maintain, I think, moving forward, maintain, you know, concerts, more concerts at the hall, because the hall is designed to play shows. We have a season that we do there, but it's also a hall that's rented out too, because, you know, like anywhere in New York City, mom and dad got to pay their bills.
Yeah.
So we find ways to create shows that will bring people more, you know, closer to Jazz Lincoln Center. You know, people are scared, you know, when Winton made the announcement of leaving.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, uh-oh, here goes, you know, there goes the rug, you know. And then, you know, they start thinking, oh, who's going to come in, you know? There's nobody that can come in. Who are we going to get, you know? I mean, there are many names have been floating, you know?
Yeah, but,
they're out there. They're
but
out
in
there.
The words of Lester Young, do you got eyes?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had eyes since I stepped foot into Jazz Lincoln Center. It's a bigger responsibility, and it's a harder position to fulfill. It has nothing to do with what I know, what I can do. There's just other things that, you know, you got board members that you have to
sure.
deal with. You have, you know, there's a lot of stakes involved, you know.
Fundraising. Leadership.
Yeah, leadership.
Setting the culture. Those aren't small ticket items.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty happy with how I'm setting my culture at Jazz Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows me as the kid that brings the Latin music to jazz.
Yeah.
You know, it could be a stereotype. I'm cool with it, because I love both styles of music. I studied both styles of music, you know, and I'm there. I could play both. You want me to play, I could play, you know.
I remember when we were recording shows at Murray Street for mm-hmm. Jazz at Lincoln Center, there was a time where there were shows at Lehman College in the Bronx, where we were doing Gillespiana and
yeah.
some really incredible stuff. Yeah. Like, you know, getting into that neighborhood, obviously the concerts in Central Park.
That's right, yeah.
You know.
See, all that stuff needs to come back. We need to do that. We need to get back into the community and let them know that Jazz Lincoln Center, now moving forward, is embracing the culture of what, you know, of what it is. I mean, you know, jazz is based on African music. It's based on African rhythms.
Yeah.
Afro-Cuban music, African rhythms. Everything we do is all African rhythms, right? There's no denying it. So we need to figure out a way of sourcing everything as one, so people understand that we're all in it together.
Yeah.
You know, if we could put that together, I think Jazz Lincoln Center will take it to another level. You know, much higher than with, you know, where Winton had placed it. I mean, it's already at a high level now. I mean, we could just sit back and play the playbook that he wrote.
Sure.
And it'll run itself. But I think for a visionary, somebody who wants to see something change, I think, you know, culturally, I think the people of New York need to find out what Jazz Lincoln Center is. And it doesn't have to be about how much money you have too, you know. Because a lot of people feel, and this is just out of fear that, oh, I don't have that much money, I can't be a part of Jazz Lincoln Center, or I can't see a show.
Right.
You know, if we find ways to make it easier for a community base to see our shows with their music and combining it with jazz. You know, then I think the world could, I mean, the world, of course, but the community could open up and see things.
Winton is your colleague as well as your mentor. How are the conversations changing now that he is sort of, you know, kind of slowly fading?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. You know, it's not easy. It's not easy. I mean, we just came back. I just got back from Japan and South Korea. And every encore, he gets to stand in front of me and play, and he's playing his butt off. But you know, there's a slight second of tear jerking that just happens quickly, and then you just get back to it. Man, you sound good. But we're gonna feel it. I'm gonna feel it, because you know, it's hard to explain when a musician is on stage and it's a spiritual thing, and they're playing for their father, their mom, you know, people that were there before him. You know, it's like it's a field of energy that you feel when you're playing with them. It's not just, you know, we're just playing a standard. I mean, we feel this energy when we're playing it, so that he takes us on this trip and we're a part of it. To know that there's going to be a future where he's not going to be around for that. I'm not saying that he won't come back and play with us, but, you know, it's reality. And it separates the kids from the adults. In other words, you start thinking, okay, you know, I'm not a kid no more. Like, I need to step up and keep this alive. You know, he's given us the opportunity to do this. We need to really, and not just me. I mean, I'm talking about like Chris Cranshaw. We got cats in the orchestra who have developed and given the orchestra so much throughout the years. You know, the entire orchestra, it's not just two or three, but, you know, we have certain members where we know that we could drop the load on them and they'll be able to carry. So, you know, the conversations with Winton are very sparse. You know, I try not to get in it because we'll start crying. Mm. Oh, it's deep. It's like we haven't really connected eye to eye, because I'll start crying, he'll start crying. It's really that emotional, because I mean, he's known me as a kid. He knew my mom before she passed away. He's the godfather of my first child. I mean, it's just a beautiful story, you know, of what a mentor would do, you know, a musical father figure. So, you know, it's hard. And of course, the changes also are going to be hard, because he only has but so much that he can do, you know, to say, hey, you know. And I'm sure the board is giving him the first call to, you know, how would you want this to change?
Yeah.
But he, you know, he is also in a position where he's like, you know, how am I going to do this? You know, I want to fulfill everybody's dream. I also want to activate everybody in the field or in a position where they won't be failing, you know, because you don't want to put somebody somewhere where they're going to just fall apart. And, you know, a true leader like him sees and knows that. So, you know, it's also that aspect of, you know, it's interesting. You know, we'll talk to each other for a minute, you know, we'll say, you know, I always write to him, man, I love you, bro. Yeah, you sounded great yesterday, you know, and it's just, man, you remember? You know, then I'll start sending him photos, like when I was 17 with him. Bro, remember this? You know, and then we'll melancholy and start talking, and then we'll, you know. But it's going to be rough.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be rough. It's going to be a hard one. It's going to be a hard one. I mean, it's not a, it's going to be just an emotional hard one. You know what I mean? It's not a bad thing. Everything needs change. He knows it. I know it. And the best part about it, to his defense, is that he raised a group of great musicians, this generation now, or the generation I'm in. He raised a hell of a great group. So it's not, you know, it's not going to fall into, you know, it's not going to go down. I mean, you know, and it's a lot of support, you know. And also, you know, I mean, we've been talking about this with Winton, but, you know, I also have this vision of creating this Latin initiative at Jazz Lincoln Center. It's been the talk for a while now, and Winton and I have always been talking about that. So, you know, that's also when you start asking about leadership, do you want to step into the role of Jazz Lincoln Center? That would be also my foot into becoming somewhat of an artistic director of the Latin Initiative, which again talks about the cultural integration of what San Juan Hill was and my music, you know, being a New Yorican, you know, and incorporating other styles, you know, with the influence of jazz and giving people a whole new perspective of what this music can do as a single form that is able to invite, you know. So you're not just one, we're all united. And if we could teach them that and they could hear it, you know, I think we're in a good place, good spot.
I'm hearing a lot of it in Monk Conclave.
Yeah, that's it. A lot of the concepts that I just spoke about are there. Yeah, it's a little I Mean You.
Yeah. Not only on solo bass, but you also had your own rhythm section going. Yeah, I could hear your breath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm puffing, huffing and puffing.
Yeah. Well, you were puffing out some
singing.
Clave, too.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, it's an honor to play this bass. I used this for the same recording, the Monk Conclave. So it's a French instrument, a French bass that belonged to the great Bobby Rodriguez, who was the bassist for the Tito Puente Orchestra, Machito Orchestra, and many great orchestras. And this bass, I was lucky enough to receive it or purchase it through my boy, my homie, Ruben Rodriguez, great bassist too. And this instrument has been my joy. I've been playing it for a while now, and it's my go-to.
How might have Bobby Rodriguez sounded on this instrument?
Oh, many. Many recordings.
Yeah.
Oh, there's many, many. I mean, his initials are on the scroll. Many photos of him with this bass. He's recorded Mas Bajo. He's recorded the Timon Bo. Yeah. This recorded. Right? This recorded the Afro-Cuban Suite. This recorded, there's so many of them. This recorded Cayuco, recorded one of his first solos, you know. There's so many recordings. This bass, you know, I grab it and I'm like, wow, you know, so much history. It's an honor to play it and to play these notes, you know. It's a lot of respect. You know?
And maybe even a little bit of Paul Chambers sneaking in there.
Oh, man, yeah. Visitation.
Ah.
Yeah, that's another one that PC would do. All those licks. PC was my man too. You know, when PC, when I was first introduced to PC, it was through Victor Venegas, and my dad bought me a cassette tape that had PC on one side and Eddie Gomez on the other side. And I tell you, all throughout junior high school and high school, I must have played the cassette tape over and over again.
Two very different basses.
Oh, totally different.
Yeah.
Totally different. So yeah. I had Eddie Gomez with the Bill Evans Trio, and then I had PC with bass on top, you know. You know, that one. You know?
That's the record where he also does Yesterday's on Arco.
I think so, yeah. Yusuf Lateef did a lot of those arrangements.
Yeah.
But, you know, I listened to that every day. I was just listening to that. And, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
The old Stockholm.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. Man. I used to listen to all that stuff. It just brings back when I hear those records, I smell the 2 Train getting off on 72nd.
You smell the 2 Train?
Oh, I could right now, if I listen to that recording, just that right?
Yeah.
I would definitely think about the 2 Train, Grace Papayas on 72nd Street, you know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Just that walk to LaGuardia High School. I would do that walk a lot. Because I didn't want to change to the 1 sometimes, so I'd just do that. Yeah, I mean.
You stop for a dollar dog?
A dollar dog. And by the time you walk to school, hopefully you burned it. I mean, you burned the calories. At that age, you were burning everything. I mean, you know, PC, Mingus, man, all of them. Doug Watkins, yeah. Ron Carter. I just saw Ron. Ron's the man. He's so slick. Ron, I saw him at Jazz Lincoln Center. I went up to the dressing room, you know. Hey, Mr. Carter. He said, hey, Carlito, how you doing? And he put his hand in his pocket. Hey, I got something for you. And I'm like, man, what he's going to give me? He's probably going to give me something really valuable or something. And he whips out a quarter. He says, you owe me a call. That's what he said. You owe me a call. And I looked at him. I'm like, okay, I owe you a call, Mr. Carter. All right.
But, he said something very interesting to me once when I interviewed him at his lovely apartment. You know, he said... Near the end of the interview, he said, when I'm coming off the bandstand, you know, a lot of people think that I'm a bit cold. He said, but, you know, what I'm really doing is I'm literally processing the set and all of the mistakes I've made.
Yeah, he's an interesting cat, man. I've met him. The earliest encounter with him was when I was 15. There's something with the Ernie Wilkins Orchestra. And I went to Carol's studio, and I sat next to him.
Yeah.
And my way into Ron Carter's zone, right, because he has a territory where
sure.
he doesn't allow many people to get in, was Victor Venegas.
Mm.
I mentioned Victor, and he was like, hey, Victor, that's my boy. You know, I was like, I never seen anybody just change. And, from there on, we just spoke. You know, he spoke highly about Victor.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you, it was again, like I said, like the book was written in a certain way where all the pieces were, you know, were there for me.
Yeah.
And I was able to absorb, you know, the energy and the knowledge.
Now it's your chapter to write.
Yeah. I'm trying.
You are now at the age of your mentors when you were young.
Pretty much, yeah.
You feel a certain responsibility?
Oh, yeah. I do, man. Every day I feel like, you know. Because, you know, you see everyone passing away. Like, you know, just recently, just yesterday, we had this great historian of Latin music, Joe Conzo. He just passed away. Mm. And he was 83. And, you know, I get the call like at 9, 10 p.m. And I'm like, damn, you know, Joe went, you know. And, you know, I get call from Jose Madera, who's, you know, the great percussionist who played with Tito Puente and did all the arrangements. And he's telling me, man, we lost Joe. I was like, man, we lost Joe, but we also lost like a generation of encyclopedic, you know, like this guy lived it. So it's not like he read a book, like he was there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's tough, you know, and now that I'm 46, you know, I'm like, man, I understand now where Wynton why he does what he does in terms of spreading the knowledge. Like I see people like McBride, how he is now more aware of students with his jazz house camp, you know, how he wants to like give them all the knowledge that they can. How Chick was, Chick Corea before he passed away.
Yeah.
It's interesting, man, how that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an element also, I mean, it's actually very prominent on Jeremy Pelt's new record. Our community will not be erased.
That's right.
And, you know, unless there's inherently a responsibility for musicians to carry this on, there is a danger that if you don't tell the story, someone else will, and it may not be yours.
It might be, yeah, it might not be yours. You're right.
Yeah.
And that's, the, you know, that's exactly all the recordings that I've put together. It's a storytelling, you know, it's, I'm just telling you what
story,
they are.
Tale.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in there.
They're in there, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do as much as you can to allow people to understand why and how. Yeah. And hopefully they'll fall into the cracks and they'll start enjoying what you do. And then they'll bring other people.
Carlos Enriquez, thank you for joining us on The Late Set.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Swing us out. Just, you know, it could just be walking like mad, whatever you want. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Will.
Josh, great conversation with Carlos. I expected no less. He's such an insightful and sort of warm and generous presence. You can see why so many people love working with him. And it's interesting to me to think about how much he's been able to carve out within the kind of fishbowl of jazz at Lincoln Center. And I say that, you know, I'm not being disparaging, but there's an ecosystem that it represents.
Absolutely.
And it's very easy, I think, for a musician, because what they do is so rich and they're busy. They're traveling the world, they're making albums, they've got a full concert season, you know, all kinds of new music and refurbished old music. I mean, it's a full-time job and a half, right?
And a powerful education mechanism.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it's very, very easy and probably tempting to just live inside of that and feel fulfilled. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But if you're not plugged into that network, you know, and I'm a little less plugged in than I used to be, now that I'm not covering the New York scene for a New York publication, you know, you sort of, there's a blind spot, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, whatever happened to so-and-so. It's like, oh no, that cat is actually really busy.
Yeah.
You're not getting all of it, you know? And Carlos, I think, you know, it's really commendable because he does these things that kind of break through and indicate that while he is very much in that system, he's looking beyond it, at least. Right?
Yeah. You know, I also think he has always had some aspect of the pulse of New York as part of his grounding as a musician, you know, whether it was in the Bronx and studying with Andy Gonzalez, going through LaGuardia, you know, into Juilliard. He's sort of been in all these spaces as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's had experience around the pike.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this album, which I agree with you, it's a real winner. Of course, there's something so satisfying about taking Monk's music. It's so sturdy and has such integrity that you can do a lot of different things with it.
You can change the rhythm.
You can do so much, right? And it still maintains a sort of essential character, which is really, that's the magic of it. And so it's great to hear all the things that he does with, you know, Monk Conclave. But it's also, I think, one of my favorite pieces on this album is an original San Juan Hill, which is, you know, entirely his conception. Now, I'm sure he's thinking about Monk as he's writing this tune and orchestrating it. But it's, I mean, what a killer, killer piece of music this is.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And all those musicians on there, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
It's like, we didn't talk about Bad Bunny, but, right. I
missed opportunity.
I know, there. I totally shanked it.
But, you know, like, when, you know, he's got Jeremy Bosch doing his thing, and he's got, you know, I mean, Gonzalo, of course, Gonzalo Rubalcaba, all throughout this album. I mean, it's just a lot of people really firing on all cylinders, which is just exciting.
Yeah. Monk Conclave from Carlos Enriquez.
I want to also get a little post-game wrap-up about this Jazz at Lincoln Center sidebar. because this is a really interesting topic of conversation.
Yeah.
I hope that here on the Late Set, we'll eventually have a chance to talk with Wynton, maybe an exit interview.
Be great.
Of sorts. But obviously what he's accomplished, what Wynton has accomplished there is singular. It's a very enticing and perplexing thing to try to game out, you know, who could step into that role. And so I want to hear your thoughts about the way that Carlos answered that question.
Well, I mean, I think he's right to acknowledge that he did come up through the system, as mm-hmm. it were. I mean, as Wynton agrees to step off or sort of transition, as it were, off of the leadership role at Jazz at Lincoln Center, you know, it must be something to look at someone like Carlos and to recognize all of the things that I dreamed about in terms of creating this structure for the music to thrive, to flourish, mm-hmm. you know, some aspects of it to really be celebrated in a significant way for American culture. And to see that there is a member of the orchestra there who is representative of that, you know, long game
mm-hmm.
for decades,
right.
you know. And I think Carlos was right to acknowledge that. And, you know, I think he would honestly make a very strong inside candidate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not to say that I'm sure the board is going to do their due diligence on this and look at a number of different opportunities. But, you know, as it relates to somebody who is right there in front of you.
Right.
It's worth a conversation.
And it's not just, you know, the bird in the hand or the known, but it's also, as you say, like proof of concept, you know, this idea that look at what an incredible artist this is and how successfully he's navigated this entire pipeline, you know, from early musical education all the way through.
And maintained the voice of what he wanted to represent in the music.
Right. And it's certainly very meaningful to imagine someone in a leadership role at that organization who is deeply plugged into the New Yorkian community, right?
Agreed.
That would be really powerful.
Totally agree.
It kind of reminds me when you talk about the inside candidate, and maybe this is on my mind because I just came from International Jazz Day, which is, you know, an initiative of the Herbie Hancock Institute of Jazz. But, you know, the director of the jazz education wing of the Hancock Institute now is Ambrose Akinmusari, who won the Monk competition back when it was the Monk Institute and also attended the Monk Institute of Jazz Performance, you know, postgraduate studies. And so he was like somebody who came through the system, won the competition, and now he's leading the education department. So it's not a perfect analogy, but that's kind of what it reminded me of.
Yeah, it's good to see an investment pay off and continue to pay dividends into an organization.
Yeah. Well, we will be watching that space. And in the meantime, we will be grooving out to Monk Conclave. And hopefully, yeah, I don't know if there's going to be a chance soon to see this project again, because, you know, Jazz at Lincoln Center, they actually just announced their next season, which is really sort of a farewell, like a long farewell to Mr. Marsalis. So there's a lot of Carlos with the orchestra on the horizon, and we might have to pick and choose some highlights there.
We'll find our hot spots. Speaking of hot spots, is it time to dig?
I think it is. Josh, you issued a disclaimer as we were heading in today that there's nothing that you're digging at the moment.
I'm coming in empty-handed and maybe with some first mind, empty-minded.
All right. Well, that's okay because I will—
Dump something in for me.
I will do a two-parter. So as we mentioned, I was in Chicago, and after the Jazz Day concert, I went to another concert. Mike Reed's Chicago Inspirations at Symphony Hall, which is home of the CSO. And that was an amazing, amazing show. But what I want to endorse is what I did before the show. So just down the street from the CSO is the Fine Arts Building. And it's a beautiful architectural gem and home to a lot of artists and sort of maker spaces and cool little shops. And one of the shops is a bookstore called Exile in Bookville. Are you familiar with this
I am
spot?
Not.
So I didn't know anything about it, but, you know, I just on the map, I was like, you know, maybe there's a bookstore around. And it turns out there was. It's on the second floor of the Fine Arts Building.
And it's not related to Liz Phair in any way.
Well, it is in the sense that it's a bookstore that celebrates music.
Yeah.
That's part of its brief. So near the register, there's a whole bunch of vinyl. And it's albums by, you know, modern bands like The National and Japanese Breakfast. And they're all inscribed to the bookstore. You know, to Exile in Bookville, you know, whatever, whatever. And then the artist has signed it. And so they make clear that these records are not for sale, but if you're in the store browsing and you want them to put one on, they'll put it on for you.
Nice.
So that's kind of a cool little thing. There's also an entire wall of 33 and a third books, you know, so they've got their like music game. So my part A endorsement is if you are in the downtown area in Chicago, go to Exile in Bookville, great little bookstore.
Okay. Did you buy a book?
I bought a book, and that is part two of my endorsement. Part B, I picked up a book that I read some good reviews of. It's called Stephen Sondheim, Art Isn't Easy, and it's a new critical biography by Daniel Okrent, who was for a long time an editor and contributor to the New York Times. It was published just this spring as part of the Jewish Live series on Yale University Press. And I leafed through it in the bookstore and just felt like this is going to be one worth picking up. It's not that long. You know, there are other like exhaustive Sondheim biographies out there. This one's pretty slim. I think it's like 320 pages. And so it's really less about capturing the whole story and more about kind of cutting to the heart of the matter. And it's especially interested in craft, right? So I have only read about, you know, the first, I don't know, 30 pages or so, but I'm already very excited about this book. And I think it's going to yield some cool discoveries. So there you have it. If you like, I'll report back when I finished it. But I have a good feeling about this one.
All right. Send in the clowns.
Hey, now.
We're already here.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Are you enjoying this podcast? We hope you are. Please leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice. Also, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. WRTI Music is the handle. You can also email us any feedback you have to editor@wrti.org.
That goes directly into Nate's inbox.
Be nice.
Our show is hosted by Nate Chenin and me, Josh Jackson, and produced by Alex Arif. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager and mixed this episode. Our production assistants are Alexander Bolliker, Jacob Dodd, and Alana Beltran. Special thanks to Lydia Liebman.
Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate general manager for content and programming is Josh Jackson. And Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philly and beyond. And take note, our next episode will drop on Miles Davis's centennial, May 26th, and it will be a centennial Miles Davis special. We got a lot of good things coming up.
Is that what you wanted, T.O.?